Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
My guest today is Marta Homestar, who has written a biography on Christian Magnus Falsen, the prosecution's founding father. And today we're going to talk about the first half, something I find super fascinating in Norwegian and Swedish history, which is the Sweden-Norway Union. And of course, as always, I'd start with introducing our guest to how did you come in studying early 19th century history?
Thank you for the invitation. Sometimes history comes kind of by surprise. I started with studying early modern Norwegian history, and then the natural way further was 1814, and then by especially the first half of the 19th century. And of course, we had a bicentennial jubilee some years ago, which also kind of spurred the possibility to do research and get to know this period more thorough, and also to talk about it in a wider public context, I would say.
So, of course, the Sweden Union began because of the Napoleonic Wars, as you know, and Sweden were fighting against Napoleon, whereas Denmark was fighting with Napoleon. And we're not going to go into the reasons why this time, but, you know, the Norway were in Denmark, then union with Denmark for almost 400 years, and before that, I want to begin with the Russian takeover of Finland in 1808, because it's kind of essential to understanding why Sweden got Norway after 1814.
Yes, it's kind of interesting because, as you said, Norway had been a part of Denmark for 400 years, approximately, and in the same conditions as Finland had been part of Sweden. So in the Nordic countries were kind of divided. So it was Denmark, Norway on one side, and then it was Finland, Sweden on the other side. But as you can see on the map, Finland borders to Russia. And then in 1809, the Russian armed forces invaded Finland and annexed that part of the kingdom, Sweden, Finland. And of course, this was a huge loss for Sweden in very many ways. And this also resulted in a coup where the political and armed forces, the officers, overthrow the king, Gustav III, and ousted him out of Sweden. And instead, they placed a new king, the old and frail and impotent and demented Charles XIII. He had no heir, he had no sons. So everybody knew that this was kind of an intermediate solution to the governing of Sweden. At the same time, they also adopted a new constitution, which so they parted with the absolutist governing of Gustav III in the years before. And then it happens a lot, you can say, because then the new king had no sons, so they had to find a new heir to the throne. And first they contacted Christian August, as he was called. He was a Danish German prince. He was in Norway at the time, so he left his position as governor of Norway, went to Sweden and became the crown prince of Sweden. But unfortunately, he died already in 1810. So then the Swedes had to start all over again and find a new crown prince to the Swedish throne.
Of course, that would be the legendary Jean-Baptiste Bandat. Let's talk a little bit about him and how he came to end up being Swedish royalty, because he's quite a fascinating character, I think.
Yes, he has quite a life story because, as one can hear, it is not a Swedish name, it's a French name. And he was one of Napoleon's officer. He was a marshal in his army, and quite powerful. But he fell out with Napoleon. And also fell in, but in the end, and why the Swedes thought that he maybe could be the solution is one strong part is that they wanted to have an army officer. They wanted someone who could lead Sweden into battle, and that is a reference back to the loss of Finland. So because the Swedes thought at that moment that they should retake Finland as part of natural part of Sweden, and that was also the policy of Charles France, as he adopted as his reigning name. He came to Sweden. And forsake his Catholic faith, became a Protestant, and became the crown prince and acting ruler of Sweden. And of course, they tried to maneuver into the Napoleonic Wars at the time, and then in 1812, they adopted a new policy for what they wanted to achieve during this war. And he gave up the dream of retaking Finland, and instead he said, let's take Norway. Because one thing was that Finland was seen as part a natural part of Sweden, but Norway certainly is, because when you look at the map, the border between Finland and Sweden and Norway is very long, and the parts of these countries fit very well together. So Charles had to persuade his allies. But he came through with it, and that was the deal for his or Sweden's participation in the final fights against Napoleon. And then in 1813, when the downfall of Napoleon was more or less very clear. And you have the Battle of Leipzig in October, where Napoleon lost. But instead of following the French armies, to kind of give the final blow, as the other nations did, Charles John turned and went north and attacked Denmark and the German parts of Denmark. To push forward and by that get Norway.
So, of course, this brings us to the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and let's talk about the Kiel Treaty, because it does become essential for the Sweden-Norway Union and the Nordic politics for the next half century, essentially.
Yes, that's very true. The Treaty of Kiel is a peace treaty, or ceasefire after the attacks because the Danish army couldn't withstand the Swedish army. And the important part for Norway is that in this treaty, the Danish king gives up his rights to the Norwegian throne.
But I think we should also mention that Norway was independent for 3 whole seconds before we were handed over to
Yes,
Sweden.
I would maybe say it took a little bit, 8 months at least, more or less. But 14 is a very eventful year for Norway. You have two general elections, you have two constitutional assemblies, you have a war, you have three kings. So it's a lot that happens. And I should maybe talk a little bit about it because of course you have the Kiel Treaty at the start of the year. That cedes Norway to Sweden, but of course this is on paper. So messages is sent north to Norway to tell the governor of Norway at the time, Christian Frederik, who is the Prince of Denmark as well, that he is to give over the fortresses and leave and come back to Denmark. And of course there is a lot of secrecy, so you can't really tell what happens. And one of the question is, of course, what the Danish king actually tells his governor, and what he should do. But the general feeling is that he acts quite independently because he says that he will not accept the treaty, and he wants to proclaim himself as a Norwegian king because of his birthright as Danish prince. And he went on a travel through Norway to gain support. He did get the support to have an independent Norway. But he also got quite a clear message from the elite that he met, that Norway wanted a constitution. And also at a very important meeting, he one of the participants tells him that isn't it much sweeter to have been given the crown from the people than taking it by right? So he, I always see this as quite an emotional moment where they kind of have this image of how the people is going to give him the crown. So he decides that he should call for a constitutional assembly and not proclaim himself as king on this point, and give the people the right to elect the king. Of course, it was 1814. It wasn't that easy to get the message through, and they had no system to have election as we know it today. But this call for a constitutional assembly led to the election of of men. In the start of April, 112 representatives from almost all lines of Norwegian society. It was civil servants, it was representatives from the armed forces, it was farmers, which is quite important and show this egalitarian thought. And some were quite young because they couldn't find a better solution, but also but it was quite the young assembly that so the I think the age was around 30, 40 years old of this man. And just within weeks, they made this constitution. And what is maybe the most important is that it's based on popular sovereignty. Someone would describe it as the last revolutionary constitution of this era. That the constitution that came after is not based on popular sovereignty on the same sort of that. It also have quite a wide franchise. So at the time, it was quite a large portion of the men of Norway who could get to vote and have a political voice. So that's one of the important things. But of course, the Allies wasn't that pleased, and Sweden was, of course, very offended with this move. And then in the summer, first they tried to persuade Christian Frederick and Norwegian that they have to go into a union with Sweden, and they said no, and also tried to work politically. They had emissaries who went to Great Britain, and they also had support in the British Parliament for Norwegian independence. But in the end, the Swedes invaded Norway.
And
So, yeah.
this will be the last war we fought with Sweden against Norway, which would be, of course, a disaster for Norwegian forces.
Yes, it was very clear that the Norwegian armed forces went up to this land war and invasion. And also, it was what happened is that also many thought it would end in a betrayal from Christian Frederick, because quite shortly he did not want to spill Norwegian blood, so he aimed for a ceasefire with Sweden. And then in August already, very short war, they signed a ceasefire, which granted Norway its constitution, but also forced Christian Frederik as king to abdicate and leave Norway. It didn't happen immediately, because he said that I have to call for a new constitutional assembly, and they have to I have to abdicate to them, not to Sweden. So by this move, they gained power, and which also secured the constitution, which is the most important part of this. And then one had a new election, new constitutional assembly, and in the negotiation with the Swedes throughout the assembly, it ended with very few changes in the constitution, but it actually increased the parliament's power and authority. and by that strengthening Norway's inner independence, at least. But of course, foreign policy would be decided by the Swedish government and the Swedish king. So that part it kind of lost some sovereignty.
Now, I do think that Karl Johan Han as well, which was the name Sean MacTeus took after becoming Swedish king, he was reluctant to use the armed forces because it was thought that, if I invade, they're gonna hate me for sure, and they're gonna hate this unit. So but if we settle this diplomatically, they might be not be so, they might not hate me that much. Of course, I was never loved in Norway, but to that extent, he hoped for with the Union, but he was kind of reluctant using force in invading Norway, as far as I understood this.
Yes, of course, if you do invade, he wanted to have a more or less harmonious union. At the same part, an important paragraph in the Kiel Treaty was that Norway was ceded to the Swedish king and not to the Swedish realm. So he figured that if the worst was to happen with his position, he could retain Norway, even though he maybe lost Sweden. But of course, that's very don't know what happened, what would happen, and it was a lot of uncertainty. But this situation never occurred. So, but what you see is that Charlton was very reluctant to use force in the first years of his reign or as a crown prince, but acting regent of Norway, and kind of wanted to treat Norway in a way that wouldn't initiate too much political disturbance and instead kind of create an harmonious and get the Norwegian support. And of course, some people thought that the best solution for Norway were to get into the union with Sweden, and that was quite influential men. There were and it was led by maybe the one person we could call real nobility in Norway at the time, and some of the richest merchants in this period who supported a union with Sweden. So, but the other parts of Norway was quite hesitant and wanted to fight back at least until the end of 1814. But Tarzan was he was working diplomatically with the Norwegian. He tried to kind of bribe important people from the opposition, gave out orders and trying to dignify people. And Norway was in many ways ruled by the civil servants. Maybe it was kind of some mentality that they were used to have a king and accept the king. And it was the Danish king, and then they pledged allegiance to the Swedish king, and then they would kind of accept that situation. But of course, they also had other outlets to show resistance politically in the new environment of a semi-independent Norway.
So let's talk about installing the Norwegian government and how much power they had compared to, the Sweden of, and how they were going to work this together. Because I do think that they're to have an assembly with Sweden either every 5 year or every 3rd year. So let's talk about how much the Norwegian government under Sweden, Norway.
Yeah, of course you had the parliament as who had the legal and fiscal and also controlling power of Norwegian politics. They were gathered every 3rd year, which of course was could be a problem. But then you have the government who is acting in the king's name. They were named by him, and the first governments were all strong supporters of the union. But they also included some of those who had been on the opposition in 1814, and it was a kind of power struggle. But at the same time, the king was mainly in Sweden. So he was in Stockholm on the other side of Sweden. It's a distance. It takes some time to travel, at least in 1814 and around that time. So, and it ended with that you had the government in Norway, and then you had the prime minister in Sweden. So you had kind of two prime ministers. At the time, one who was leading the government in Norway, and then you had one in Sweden who was working closely with the Swedish government and the king, and had to kind of act as a diplomatic force between the different interests of the Swedish government, who was in many ways very opposed to the Norwegian independence and what they thought as arrogance. And of course, Norwegian government thought very much the same about the Swedish government. So that was a power struggle clearly from the beginning. But it was hard to end up in very kind of open conflicts because the Norwegian government answered to the king, not to the Swedish government.
And I believe that, of course, this is become essential later as we go into the later 19th century, which I hope you talk about soon as well. But you know, Ole Richter would not become it, as you know, but it was not a popular who would be prime minister in Sweden for Norway. But it was not a very popular that we talked about. It was not a very popular post in Norwegian being prime minister in Sweden. Norwegian prime minister in Sweden.
No, and the 1st years they had the same. It was one of the leading union men, you can say, from 1814, who was prime minister in Sweden, in Stockholm. But later it was kind of it went as a turn between the members of the government. So they had kind of a period each where they went to Stockholm and stayed there as acting prime ministers before they went back to Norway again to work with their departments and be part of the Norwegian government in Oslo. So it wasn't very popular, and they, because they were so close to the king, and I think Charles John was quite demanding. They very much felt this conflict between Norway and Sweden. They were maybe one of those who felt that most immediate on the conflicting interest between Norway and Sweden.
Well, how important was this job and that to have this foreign post, if you will, in Sweden?
Oh,
Was it really necessary as well to have this kind of foreign, kind of, if you will, I call it, for lack of better words, a foreign minister so close to Swedish parliament?
yes, it was important because he was going to represent the view of the Norwegian government and try to mediate the king to accept what they thought were best and in the best interest of Norway. And Charlton is known to have quite a temper and quite strong will and determination, and could not easily be swayed by other people. And so it was a difficult situation to try to navigate towards him and getting the best solutions for Norway. But at the same time, one had a quite a strong and at least vocal opposition in Norway, which is very much seen during the session of the parliament. And it happens something with the dynamic between Norway and or between the king and Norwegian politicians after then at the point where Charleston is the actual king. So that's when Charles XIII dies and he's really gets his hand on the crown. He also gets more self-confidence and puts more power behind his meanings and what he wants to have.
And I think it's also important to establish that though at this time Norway and or Scandinavia in general, they were driving towards a constitutional monarchy, though it wasn't constitutional as we know it today. Of course, the king did have some power, and among those is that Karl Johan, he would try to neglect certain parts of the constitution as well.
Yes, and of course, the opposition in the parliament were very aware of their rights in the constitution, and at the same time, the king wanted to undermine those rights. And in the 1820s, it ends up in this constitutional strife, where he. Because the constitution didn't give the king absolute veto, so he wanted to implement an absolute veto, and he also wanted to have a stronger hand in who was going to be civil servants in Norway. So that he could be able to dismiss judges, for example. So he tried to attack kind of some of this fabric in the constitution, but this was met with quite a strong opposition in the parliament, and often it's not correct, but often says that nothing is changed in the constitution in this time. It's not correct, but these important things that the king wanted to change, they would not change because they had to do that with the two-thirds majority in the parliament, and they wouldn't give him that. So we call it constitutional conservatism, this attitude against it. So as few changes as possible. And especially not changes that would alter the power between the king and the parliament. And the king tried to influence the parliament in different ways, also military. So in 1821, one had a especially rebellious parliament, and it was quite a fear amongst the number of people that Charlton would actually make a coup and overthrow the constitution and name himself as an absolutist king.
Something I want to talk about as well, and this is important as well, because the flag, of course, the flag controversy, because Norway was very much, I would dare say, a sea empire in its own right, because our fleet in international trade is massive and it deserves a future episode in its own right. But you know, there was a problem with for lack of better words, flying international waters, because you needed the flag of the nation that you had, and Norway did get our own flag, the red, white, and blue, in 1814. But of course, being in union with Sweden, we cannot use this flag as our own flag, so we needed the union flag. So let's talk about the union flag, and in order to
Yeah.
board in the international waters and international harbors, we needed the union flag on our boats, and in general, the union flag.
Yeah.
Let's talk about
Of
this for a
course,
while.
one of the most important part of the flag is to be recognized as okay, that you get you can see who is approaching you in the oceans. So that's why it was important to have an own flag. And Norway got the red, white, and blue flag in 1821. And of course that's quite a story, just that. But in the foreign waters they had to use this Union flag that was based on the Swedish flag. And as one on one side had this national flag that one can use in the near waters, as one said, North Sea and the trade to Great Britain and France, when they went further. And of course, Norway was an international sea nation at this point. This time, and even more so when, as times went by, they also felt that they should have equality with the Swedes in this part. So, from the 1830s, they came, they tried to get the Swedish king to adopt a kind of union emblem that they could use in respectively the Swedish and Norwegian flag. And it is kind of you can say a mismatch of the two flags that was to be placed in one corner of the respective flags. And this was Charleston wasn't very keen to adopt this and wouldn't accept it, and they put down commissions who negotiated between Sweden and Norway, and it was quite a case in this era. And then when as times went by, kings gets old and they die, and Charleston died in 1844, and the new king, his son Oscar the First, he is often described as a gift. He gifted Norway with this new union flag that it, in the Scandinavian tongue is referred to as the sillsalat. So it's the salad of herrings, which maybe yeah, is it tasteful or not? That is to be discussed. But this opened up for more equality between the nations in a foreign capacity, which is important at the time. And it was widely used. It was used on all state buildings, and you can find it in kind of decorations and things like that. And I've seen pictures from later in the 19th century where you find these small table flags that you put out as a decoration, a Swedish flag with Norwegian or with the herring salad and Norwegian flags with the same emblem. So it was used on both sides of the border and seen as a kind of token of equality at the time.
And something, speaking of equality, and there is something, and this would be true for very much late, even up until 20th, mid 20th century, I think, that the Swedes, they did, and of course this is not surprising perhaps, that they did not kind of look at the Norwegians as a little bit inferior to themselves.
Yes, it's both economic and cultural and political. I think it's of course very easy to see to look at the economic and cultural parts of it because the foreign diplomacy was more extended, of course, because the foreign policy was led by Sweden. But they also culturally they felt that they had a greater history as a Swedish empire. They had large part of Europe who had been controlled by Sweden at sometimes. So they felt that their heritage was greater. They were a better warfaring nation. They had imperial aspirations, which they didn't recognize that Norway had because they were led by Denmark at the same time. So, and also Swedish aristocratic culture was heavily influenced by French culture. They talked French in the high circles of Swedish aristocracy, and it's not only because the king was of French heritage, but also because of the diplomatic and cultural influences throughout the 18th century, for example. So they thought they were better both as a culture and as a nation in an international context. And of course they looked at these Norwegian peasants as they could be described with who were brute and didn't have the refinement of the Swedes at the same time.
There is a modern Norwegian historian, I think, and I was told of this by a historian friend of mine who I also had on this podcast, and he said that there is this Norwegian historian, I don't remember his name right now, but that kind of ridicules that Norway was poor in the 19th century. What do you think about his theory there?
Oh, it's kind of, but this is also a kind of national myth in Norway that we were very poor, and it's not right in that sense because, as we mentioned, we had quite a large seafaring, so we did a lot of international trade and had done from the 18th century, especially with timber. That kind of continued, and when one stopped with the timber and one continued with the fish, for example, exporting fish throughout Europe and as far as South America. So the nation wasn't poor as kind of this image gives. And of course, the position of Norway also strengthened throughout the 19th century. So even though a lot of people were poor, as they were all over Europe, it wasn't especially more poor in Norway than other places, you can say.
Something I want to talk about as well is Karl Johan, they tried to is the military presence in the Swedish military presence in Norway, and he was discussing, according to historian Bo Strøm, he was discussing a joint military with Sweden and Norway, and There was talk about military presence on military ports in Norway, but the Norwegian Parliament were, of course, very opposed to this. And as you know, not much came of this. So let's talk about Norwegian and Swedish military forces under Union.
Of course, to kind of strengthen the ties between the two nations and unified armed force would do very much in that respect. Already in 1814, the constitution secured that the Swedish king or Norwegian king, he couldn't take the armed forces, Norwegian armed forces, out of Norway, so he couldn't take Norwegian soldiers and go on some military expeditions somewhere in Europe. So that was one boundary for this. When there was times when Swedes, the Swedish armed forces, came into Norway, but then that was described as a peaceful meeting between two nations. And of course, I mentioned 1821, when they have this camping of Swedish armed forces outside of Oslo, but it was very much also a social event where Norwegian citizens came up and kind of looked at this Swedish soldiers and officers, and there were balls and interaction of a very gentile nature. It was a kind of underlying threat that he could use the Swedish armed forces in Norway. And of course, I think the Swedish government were very much in favor of getting control over the Norwegian armed forces as well. Norway's, because of the history with Denmark, the naval forces were quite present in Norway. They had. They were used to having a naval fleet, and it wasn't, of course, the same as when they went to Denmark. But the Norwegian boys went to Denmark during or before the Napoleonic Wars and served in the Danish fleet. So they were quite. They had some competence, you can say, in that regard.
And so something I want to talk about as well is, of course, the just a second here, let me just find nationalism is, of course, probably widely spread in, but if and before that, actually, I'm sorry for interrupting you there. I want to talk about the death of Karl Johan and the takeover of Oscar the First to become quite an important king for the Union.
Yes, Oscar first, he was born French, so he came with he was quite grown when he came to Sweden, but his upbringing was in Sweden and in Norway, and he learned more about Norwegian culture than his father. He could communicate in Swedish and Norwegian, so he wasn't that strange or foreign to the Norwegian public, and it was quite popular as charming and good-hearted. And so when his kind of military father finally died, who had all these conflicts with the government and the parliament, and kind of been very protective of his rights and interested in securing his position. His son didn't have to have that view and hardship. was more natural that this was part of his reign. He was more secure maybe in his role as Norwegian Swedish king. So that also led to a more gentle period for the Union, not with that many conflicts. So what's happening, it's more interior than maybe conflicts between Norway and Sweden throughout the Union, because they more or less cooperated better during Oscar the First and his sons, or at least until a time.
Something I want to talk about as well, and of course this is the result of Norway's National Day, which is 17th May, and it was allowed to be celebrated, though of course Karl Johan, who we talked about, was reluctant to celebrate, let them celebrate it. And Swedish kings did travel to Norway, but no one really did travel there and celebrate the 17th May, the Constitution, on the day of our national day. So again, Bo Strati argues that maybe if the Swedish king would have been there on the national days, this could have helped strengthen the union better morally. And of course, what do you think about this? And of course, let's talk about a little bit about our 17th of May. And I always say that if you are in Norway in May, 17th of May is of course a day to be here. It's a wild celebration.
Yes, and the celebration of the Constitution Day, it was important, and it's of course very important today. But today is not really a political day, but back then it was. And Charleston actually wanted, if they were going to celebrate the Constitution, it should be the final constitution, who was passed on the 4th of November. Everyone that knows Norwegian climate would know that that's not the day to be outside and having a parade. Excuse me. But one wanted to celebrate the 17th of May as the first constitution. And they Charleston was very opposed to this tradition and tried to suppress it. And then one have an incident in 1827 where it was end up with kind of a public celebration out in the streets of Oslo, who was met with police force who went into this crowd and beat some of the participants, and by that, so it was quite a scandal at the time, and it's very defining for, and of course it was even more strengthening for the feeling that the 17th of May is the day to celebrate, because that's Norwegian's day, and so. It is an interesting thought that Bostrot is talking about when he says that maybe if the Swedish kings had been in Norway as Norwegian kings and taken part of the celebration, they would also have a more goodwill, you can say, in the final how the union developed throughout the 19th century.
I do believe Oscar the First, which was he was kind of popular in Norway too, I think, because either him or one of his successors, I don't remember quite clearly, but he said, "I'm not the king of Sweden, Norway. I'm king of Norway." Put in Norway first instead of Sweden, which was widely popular claim that he is not just, putting Sweden ahead of Norway.
Yeah, that was very important, that in Norway he should be named first as Norway's king and then as Swedish king. But of course, even as I speak now, I talk about him as the Swedish king. So it's very it's kind of
Mm.
hard to get out of that discourse, you can say. But that was kind of this small elements that would show equality and that he was indeed the Norwegian king, and that's why it also was important to have a palace in Norway, and that he on different public statements always was named as the Norwegian king before the Swedish king. And yeah, it's presentation and how you present yourself as ruler of Norway is important to how you also are looked upon as. Of course, when the king started to talk Norwegian, when the king get to know Norwegian history, when he was more interested in what Norway was like, it also gave him more goodwill in the population. And we can talk about nationalism in Norway. It's a little bit difficult because nationalism is quite a contested word today. We can talk about kind of good nationalism and bad nationalism. Norwegian nationalism was very much about nation building in the 19th century. And of course, it was to distance itself from the Danish Norwegian past and kind of emphasize its own singularity and its own history. So very much of Norwegian history at the time is written about medieval history and the Viking Age and kind of what we know as, or at least is more widely known as Norwegian history.
I do believe at this time as well, Snorri becomes, who is largely forgotten, he becomes widely popular and rediscovered as well during this era, I think.
It's kind of course it's the romanticization of medieval times as you find all through Europe at this period. You have what happens in Germanic culture and one kind of look to the north as this bold and brave brave men, and one kind of it's different forces that kind of drives this, but from Norwegian's part it was very much about creating an own identity as an own nation and separate itself from this more well-off Danish people who lived on cream and pork. And also from the Swedish, someone was talking about this natural and kind of straightforward Norwegian men against this Swedish French diplomats influenced by something very un-Nordic, one can say. And when you read history books, and it kind of ends with they don't talk very much about the Danish period. They kind of and when they talk about Norway, they start in 1814. That's when a kind of nations started and the state is established.
And of course, then you got the infamous revolutionary year of 1848, which both occurs in not just Germany, the Habsburg Empire, and in France, of course, is because of course France had a revolution then as well. And it also something occurs in Norway, and He is such a fascinating character that he's unavoidable to talk about in this era, and that's of course, I know I've been excited to talk about him, that is the Marcus Train movement. So let's talk about his background a little bit and how he came to establish, though it would fail essentially, his kind of revolutionary movement at the time.
Marcus Trana Train. He was born from a civil servant family, but his father was imprisoned. He made economic crimes against the National Bank. So he was, if not ousted, he lost his fortune. But he was quite well educated. He was working as a journalist and as a teacher, and he was very much influenced with the revolutionary events in Europe at the end of the 1840s, and he so and influenced by socialism, so he started to organize workers, both those who worked the land, and also the very, very early industrial workers at the time.
If I may interrupt you for a second, it's also worth mentioning that he did, that you mentioned that he got inspired by the revolutions in Europe, but he also did travel and took part of a lot in, especially, I think he was imprisoned in France, Paris at one point as well, and he learned French there, and he was, when he was in France, that's what inspired his growing movement when he came back to Norway, essentially.
Yes, and but yes, so he was very much influenced with what happened in the rest of Europe, and then it was the momentum of this kind of social uprising, and that's very it's very difficult and quite problematic to do in a country that is so controlled as Norwegian society actually was, and but he organized. There were, I think, about 50,000 people. So it was a lot of people that supported him. In 1849, they had this petition, which they presented for the king. Where they established 10 kind of wishes for the development of Norway, and it was protecting the crafters and giving them better legal protection from the farm owners. It was giving or organizing the schools in a better way so they would secure better education for everyone, because that's very important when you are to build political citizens. They have to be able to read and write and understand literature, not only religious ones. And they also wanted universal suffrage for men, which is in Norway, that was quite revolutionary. As I mentioned earlier, the Norwegian Constitution of 1814 granted quite a large part of the men suffrage. This proportion had been reduced during the time as the social fabric kind of changed. It was a lesser and lesser proportion of the men who could actually be a political citizen. And that was maybe one of the most important demands that they had. All of this was just pushed away, and they said that people shouldn't be inspired by those revolutionary thoughts of Europe, and that they should accept the status quo and the good society that they had, and very paternalistic view on how the society was to be organized. But they didn't lose their spirit. And the year after 1850, there were a parliamentary session. So they raised the petition towards the parliament the year after. And what's interesting is that this is maybe one of the breakthroughs for more liberal political views in Norway. So at the same time, inspired by new Danish constitution from the year before, there were also suggestions of giving universal suffrage for men at the local level, not at the state level, but at the local level. And that would be, of course, a quite large step towards universal suffrage also at the national level. But nothing of this was passed. Of course, it was kind of heartbreaking, or at least negative outcome for Markus Tranmæ, who had been the leader of this movement. And there were some events in the capital.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
During the summer, and it became a rumor that they had stated that they would make an actual revolution, armed revolution, to get their will. And so he and a lot of the other leaders of the movement, they were arrested. And the larger movement kind of fell apart after that. So it was a very negative outcome for them personally. And he was also they were prosecuted, and they were imprisoned for a number of years. So the personal cost for Markus Tranmæ was quite large and heavy. And there is, of course, a discussion if what happened to him is really beyond the law, that he was the victim of the justice at the time. And their ill will, actually. But at the same time, in a wider context, it raised a discussion of how not only this one third of the society, or the male society, one had to say, was to have this political rights, but then this other large part would have no rights to vote. Because also people who were well off could not, it wasn't automatic that they could have the right to vote, for example, and educated people, lawyers, if they didn't kind of qualify through this quite narrow paragraphs in the constitution, they didn't get the right to vote. So it started a discussion of who was to be a political citizen in Norway, which kind of went, it took half a century, but it had to start somewhere, and that's where it started.
And of course, Markus Tranmæ, he did eventually get released, and he ended his days in the New World in America, but that's of course a story for later. But I think we're gonna round it up there because you're mainly, as you know, you mainly stated you mainly studied the early parts of the 19th century. So I think we're gonna save the later part of the 19th century for a later episode. Thank you so much for coming on this broadcast. Do you have, before you go, do you have anything you want to promote on the social media where people might find you or contact you if they have any questions?
No, I think I just have to urge people to get to know this period of Norwegian history because we are kind of a little bit on the outskirts of Europe and what happens there, but we're also kind of the history of the democratic evolution of Norway is quite interesting and should be also inspiration for what happens today, I think.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. My name is Adam. We are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you're on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a little review if you like this episode. And also do check out some of our other episodes. You're definitely going to find something you like. Last year, we made an episode on the Constitution, which I highly recommend checking out, which was really great, fantastic episode. Please like, share, and subscribe, and I'll see you next time.